I'm your host, Rick Kleffel, and our guest today is Alistair Reynolds, an award-winning science fiction writer from Wales and an astronomer for the ESA, the European Space Agency. His first novel, Revelation Space, was shortlisted for both the British Science Fiction Association, BSFA, and Arthur C. Clarke Awards. His second novel, Chasm City, won the 2002 BSFA Award. Ace has now published U.S. editions of Revelation Space and Chasm City. Diamond Dogs, now on the British Fantasy Award shortlist for Best Short Fiction, is a limited edition chapbook from PS Publishing and appeared at the end of 2001. Another standalone book, the novella Turquoise Days, has just been issued by Golden Griffin at the Worldcon Science Fiction Convention. Al, can you tell us how you came to write science fiction?
I've always loved science fiction. One of my very earliest memories is watching Star Trek. In fact, the only two television programs I remember vividly from when I was sort of 4 or 5 years old, one was Star Trek and one was The Virginian. And ever since then, I've always had an interest in science, space travel, and cowboys, and horses, I should add. So science fiction has always been something that's been a part of my life ever since I was really small. Even when I was just starting school in the UK, we had infant school. I used to make little books, so I draw stories with maybe a few words and on separate pieces of paper and staple them together. And one of the earliest ones I remember was about an astronaut who goes to the moon, and he takes his robot sort of rover with him, and when they get to the moon they have to make a calculation. So I remember I'd seen on Star Trek that whenever Captain Kirk asked his computer for a sort of calculation, this sort of printout would come out and he'd sort of rip this piece of paper off and look at it and say, "Look at this, Mr. Spock." So this robot and this astronaut go to the moon and they start spooling out all this printout, and it just goes on uncontrollably and covers the entire moon in printout. And that was my first science fiction novel, self-published at the age of 5, an edition of one.
And did your interest in science fiction lead you to an interest in science?
Yes, I think it was the one led to the other, because by the time I was sort of 8 or 9, I was sufficiently interested in science fiction that I was reading avidly the works of writers like Clarke, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, basically all the science fiction that our local school library had, and there was stuff like Philip K. Dick as well. But I found eventually I ran out of the novels of Clarke and Asimov, and I really loved those. So you start looking around to see what else they've written, and both those writers had written a lot of non-science fiction, popular science books. Asimov in particular wrote hundreds of these things. And I really found these were just as interesting to me as the books, and I just got the same kick, same sense of wonder jolt out of reading about the planets and the stars and physics and stuff like that. And I think what really crystallized it for me was around about 1980 in the UK, we had that program that Carl Sagan did, Cosmos series, which was a huge hit and inspired a lot of people. And I remember thinking at that time that this is when I had my first real clear picture of what, say, an astronomer actually did. You know, astronomers were not sort of hallowed figures in white coats who lived on the top of mountains. They were sort of real people who'd come through the educational system, studied, and had got jobs at observatories, and they had a certain role in life, which was to study the stars, collect data, make observations and theories. And I thought, you know, I'm quite interested in this. And from that point on, I started thinking seriously about pursuing a career in science.
And now you managed to get a job as an astronomer with the ESA. Could you discuss the ESA in contrast to NASA? And what is the ESA doing? What's their goal?
Well, European Space Agency is an organization that has its roots going right back to the 60s. And, you know, in the 60s, the UK had its own rocket program, which was eventually going to lead to sort of quite ambitious plans for spaceflight, the Blue Streak program. And this sort of faltered. The government didn't really want to keep putting money into it. And out of the ashes of that, a lot of the British rocketry specialists ended up moving to Europe, and there was a sort of nascent European organization called the European Launcher Development Organization. There was also a sort of scientific counterpart to that, European Space Research Organization. And these things merged in the 70s into the European Space Agency, which is a way for all its, you know, there's various European member states subscribe to this organization, put money in, so that they can achieve things on a pan-European level that could not be done by any one nation state. So in a way it is Europe's answer to NASA, But there are clear differences in the sort of roles of the two organizations. NASA has an obvious and highly visible manned spaceflight program. It has the shuttle. Europe does not have its own independent launch capability for putting people into space. But nonetheless, Europe has an established track record of launching unmanned satellites. And within the European Space Agency, we have one department that's focused on space science, and this has had a long and successful record in putting astrophysics, astronomy, planetary science missions into space, having them function successfully, and then making scientific advances based on the data that these missions collected. So back in the 80s, we sent a probe into the heart of Halley's Comet. Since then, we've had missions to map the positions of the stars with incredible accuracy. We've had X-ray satellites, infrared satellites. There's an X-ray satellite up there now. There's a gamma ray mission which is going to be launched very soon, and then there's sort of ambitious plans for the future. Trips to Mars, trips to the outer planets. From a science focus point of view, it's been a very successful endeavor.
Could you talk about how your career as an astronomer shapes your science fiction?
Well, I think the two things are not as intimately connected as I hoped they would be. I remember when I was sort of focusing on the possibility of having a career in science, I was reading books by people like Joe Haldeman, a science fiction writer I greatly admire, and people like Gregory Benford. And one of the things a lot of these guys had in common was that they'd studied physics or astronomy academically. And I kind of took this as sort of a prerequisite for being a science fiction writer. Like, they wouldn't let you into the club unless you'd had a physics degree or something. And I only now I realize how totally stupid this was. And some of my favorite science fiction writers have never ever had any scientific training, but they just know how to write about it convincingly. From pretty early on, I found that the two things were never particularly intimately connected. The type of science fiction I write is baroque, far future, hundreds or thousands of years into the future, way out into the universe. The kind of science I do is very focused on tight, well-specified little problems, and to take something, to translate from one to the other has never been something I'm very good at. So I tend to find that I use one half of the brain during the day when I'm in sort of science research mode, and then I go home and I write, and there's very little crosstalk between the two. But the only positive thing I can say is that because I've had a scientific training, I can go back to journal articles in places like Nature and read fairly mathematically dense papers and things like that for research purposes. But none of that's coming from my own particular areas of interest.
In some ways, the stark, dark reality of your science fiction seems to be a reaction against a lot of the very popular science fiction that people are most familiar with. Could you talk about science fiction in general and where you see your work in contrast?
Well, I started writing seriously science fiction about 15 years ago, and I think it's you often don't really know what you're going to end up writing until you've written it. And it's only now, having written three books and 20 odd short stories and a few novellas and things like that, that I'm beginning to get a handle on the type of science fiction I write. And one thing that people often say is that my stuff is dark, noirish, kind of bleak and cold. And well, I don't think of myself as being someone like that, and I'm actually quite an optimistic person in real life. But a lot of science fiction, particularly stuff that's been written sort of since the 60s, has been to me like just far too relentlessly technophilic. And I always felt that no, technology is a means to an end, but it's not universally good. It depends how we apply it, and it can have disastrous consequences as well. And another thing that I've always felt pretty clearly was that space is basically an inhospitable environment, and that if we as a species want to move beyond the Earth and start exploring the galaxy, we're going to find that the universe doesn't owe us anything and isn't particularly interested in our long-term survival. And in my books, I've tried to reflect that by giving a kind of face to the inhospitability of the universe by populating with various vicious, predatory alien civilizations. Personally, I think there isn't any intelligent life out there, but I've dramatized that for fictional purposes.
Could you talk about the universe found in your novels Revelation Space, Chasm City, and your newest novel, Redemption Arc?
Well, a lot of my favorite science fiction writers, we all focus on a certain strand of science fiction. We can read across the whole genre and beyond into other genres and mainstream fiction, but there'll always be a type of a strand of writing that appeals to us. And one thing that I've always loved is future histories. So way back in the 40s, Robert Heinlein is usually credited with the first science fiction writer to link together certain numbers of his stories and put them into the context of a kind of timeline, so that Heinlein was writing stories set hundreds of years apart, but they were in the same universe and they were linked by being part, they were set against a consistent background that he adhered to in his fiction. And then since then, writers like Larry Niven, Stephen Baxter, plenty of others have played the same game, and it's a really satisfying process to sort of build up a consistent universe with these little narrative building blocks, whether they're stories or novels, and to make sort of subtle or less than subtle connections between stories that sometimes the readers will pick up on, sometimes they don't, and it's kind of like building a really intricate puzzle. My stuff is very much part of that tradition, but in order to try and do something that's a little bit different for myself, I've rejected some of the common SF assumptions. Now, one of the things that we all see in science fiction films like Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, is that it's really easy to travel around the galaxy. You just press a red button and suddenly you make the hyperdrive jump or something, and you get from A to B. And as an astronomer, it's always been rammed home to me that the universe is just a frighteningly huge place, and even the nearest star is just unspeakably far away. Even if we could travel at the speed of light, it would take 4 years to get there. And with any conceivable technology, it's going to take a hell of a lot longer than that. And the nearest star isn't even that an interesting place to go. If you wanted to really get out into the galaxy and start traveling hundreds and thousands of light years, this is going to take a long time. And I wanted to reflect that in my stories. So I said, well, we're not going to have any faster than light travel. Einstein said it's probably not going to be possible. So we'll have no faster than light travel. We'll have no faster than light communication. So we'll have lots of colonies spread out across the galaxy, but at any one time, they don't really know what's going on in the other places because light signals take so long to get there. And you've got these enormous spaceships arcing between these worlds, taking hundreds of years to travel from A to B. And then, because of the kind of disparity between the rate of time as perceived aboard these ships and the rate of time as perceived aboard on planets with planetary cultures, you get all these sort of interesting frictions building up. And for me, that's useful because it generates all sorts of story possibilities. Now, there's other writers who've done similar things, so I'm not claiming any great originality for that, but it's kind of the central determining paradigm of my universe is the fact that you can't go faster than light. And a lot of the gloom and darkness just comes from that, the fact that it emphasizes the huge bleakness of outer space.
Now, to match the bleakness of outer space, your characters are also darker and much more complex than the characters often found in science fiction novels. Though they exist in a far future, they're compelling to readers in the present. Clavain from your latest novel, Redemption Arc, is a particularly powerful figure. Could you share your thoughts on characterization with the listeners?
Yeah, well, I read a lot of crime novels. I try and read outside the genre, and one thing I particularly like is the kind of hard-edged, mean streets crime novels, particularly the sort of the American strand that goes right from Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, through to writers like James Ellroy, James Lieber, Lawrence Block. I just devour these books, and one of my favorite books for a long time, and still is L.A. Confidential by James Ellroy, and I like the whole of that quartet. And his characters are, in his own words, bereft of sympathy. And I remember reading, I think it was The Big Nowhere, and thinking that the structure of that book, it could be L.A. Confidential actually, but the structure of L.A. Confidential has distinct narrative strands where you're in the mind of a particular character, then you swap into the mind of another character. None of these characters were particularly sympathetic in sort of standard literary terms, but they were engaging to me as a reader, and I felt that this was something I wanted to sort of try and translate into space operatic terms. So in a way, what I'm doing is just nicking the types of dark, complex, conflicted characters you get in crime novels and putting them into a science fictional context. And it's no more original than that.
Well, Chasm City, the latest novel available here in the States, is very much a mystery novel in your science fictional setting. Could you talk a little bit more about how that novel develops your feeling for mystery?
Yeah, well, I'd written Revelation Space, and this was a long time ago. It was a long time before I had any hint of a contract or book offer, and Revelation Space was sort of ticking over. I think I'd submitted it to a publisher, but submitting a novel, getting a contract is a really long, drawn-out process for most people. And I found that one summer I was thinking, well, I've just done a few short stories, now what am I going to do? And I thought, I know what I'll do is I'll try and write a novella, say a 30,000-word story set in my universe, the one I constructed for Revelation Space and the associated stories, and I try and do a kind of mean streets thriller in that universe, just for the hell of it, see what happened. It'd keep me happy for a few weeks. So I started writing this kind of self-conscious thing where this kind of typical character with a wound, sort of trench coat type figure, is wandering these mean streets looking for someone. And I set up this revenge thriller where he's going after someone who's killed this woman he likes, and it just all blossomed from that and just took on extra layers of complexity, and it mutated from a novella into a novel and then into a big fat novel. And but all along I tried to keep those mystery elements there. It's not really a detective story because there's not really a crime that's really sort of unraveled in the course of the story, but I think there are sort of nods to detective fiction and mystery fiction there. What I think one at one point in the future I'd like to do a pure detective story set in the future history, just a clear-cut noirish detective story with a detective. I've got some vague ideas for that now, and they're sort of bubbling under, and hopefully I can develop those within a few years and do something with them.
We're here speaking with Alistair Reynolds, an award-winning science fiction writer from Wales and an astronomer for the European Space Agency. Alistair, a lot of politics plays into the parts of your novels, and you've created two groups called the Demarchists and the Conjoiners. Could you talk about what they are, what they mean to your universe, and how they relate to current world events, if at all?
Well, for the purposes of writing a story, any kind of science fiction story, any story in fact, any kind of conflict you can create is useful. And one way you can easily generate conflict is by having opposed factions, or people, factions that have slightly differing views on how to achieve something. Like, I love Cold War thrillers and spy films, stuff like that. And I always really like the idea of two massive power blocks that are sort of scraping against each other, and spies and espionage and all that stuff. So I always wanted to have something similar in my future history. Yeah, there are two basic factions. There's the Demarchists. Now, the term Demarchy is a term I first encountered in a science fiction novel by a writer, American writer Joan D. Vinge, actually. And she wrote a book called The Outcasts of Heaven Belt, which is a really nice book. It's really short. I think it's quite underrated. It's probably written in mid-70s, something like that. And she introduced me to this idea of participatory democracy. So everyone's wired into a kind of computer system whereby they can vote in real time on any events that have to be decided upon. So I, fired up by that, I then sort of started rooting around to find out where this idea would come from, and I found out that this was a real political idea that she latched onto. So I thought, okay, if it's a real idea, I can have it as well. So I grabbed that and put it into my story. So I have this Demarchist faction, and to give it a slightly different tweak, my Demarchists have implants in their heads that allow them to participate in this real-time democracy, but with extreme efficiency, to the point that they're almost not aware of it happening. So they're constantly being queried on events, and this is almost taking place on a sort of subliminal, subconscious level. And of course, it's a little bit creepy because they don't really know, really on a conscious level, what they're voting for anymore. It's just all so seamless. In contrast to that, or if you like, an even more extreme version, I have another faction, which are the Conjoiners, and these are kind of like the Borg. They're a kind of hive mind, but I try to make them a kind of sympathetic Borg, the kind of cuddly Borg you might want to go and bring home and show to your mother. And they're a faction that started experimenting with ways to enhance their brain power, and they tried sort of replacing bits of their brains with computers to speed up thought processes, and then they started linking their minds together so they could swap thoughts and images. And finally, they just built, wired themselves all up into a sort of a hive mind, but they retain a degree of individuality, and I think it would be extremely difficult for me to write from the perspective of one of these conjoiners if there wasn't some glimmer of individuality there. So the character Clavain you mentioned earlier on, he starts off as a kind of an old soldier fighting on the enemy of the conjoiners, and then he kind of goes down to try and reason with them to try and stop a last minute war, and he gets sort of he kind of gets convinced that they're actually the good guys, and he decides to defect to them. And I had a lot of fun playing with him, defecting to the conjoiners, and then sort of working his way through different levels and trying to, you know, he never really fits in, and that's the kind of kickoff point for the third book, Redemption Arc, when he begins to realise that perhaps it's time to defect back, because there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Do you see any analogues between the Daemarcus and the conjoiners in today's world?
Not really, I don't think so. If there are, it just escapes me. I mean, there's a certain strand of thinking in science fiction and beyond, what they call extropian thinking, where people are talking about, you know, I'm not an expert on it, but I think they sort of advocate things like uploading, you know, cloning, body modification, immortality, uploading your mind into computers, colonizing the space, and I sort of take a dim view of all this, and I think it's all very useful speculative material to a writer, but it's not something I particularly feel any kind of emotional attachment to. In fact, a lot of it slightly repels me. But I'm quite prepared to use this stuff creatively as a writer. But I'm not a, you know, in terms of politics, I'm not a particularly politically minded writer. I know where I stand politically, and I'm kind of lukewarm in terms of my politics. I'm not particularly committed, unlike a lot of the writers coming out of the UK at the moment, who have very, very clearly defined political standpoints. I'm not one of those writers, and politics is never something that's interested me, either personally or in terms of my fiction.
Could you talk about the decay of technology that you portray in your novels?
Well, decaying technology is just something that, you know, to put it bluntly, it's far more interesting to write about something that's rusting and falling apart and scabby than something that's shiny and new. There's just many more adjectives you can use, and, you know, things that break down just generate stories. You know, if all technology works seamlessly, as it probably will in the future, it wouldn't be very interesting. You know, it's extremely difficult to tell stories in which everything works perfectly, and I find for my future history I've made up all these reasons why the technology is imperfect. Although it's fairly advanced technology, it's susceptible to sort of corrupting viruses and things like that, and the spaceships are all mutating because they've been infected with the wrong sort of virus, and the cities are all transmogrifying because the sort of the intelligent buildings have all started going amok, and the characters all have sort of weird things going on inside them because they've come into contact with the wrong sort of plagues and things. And you know, it's not something I see as necessarily plausible, but it just makes it a more interesting environment for me as a writer. And I've always loved sort of old technology. I was born in a town in Wales where, at the end of the 60s, when they were getting rid of all the steam locomotives in the country because they were scrapping out steam, they brought hundreds of these things to my town and just let them rust. And I remember just seeing hundreds of these things just rusting away, these awesome technological machines that had been, you know, the ultimate high tech, the ultimate epitome of high tech 50 years earlier, were now just rusting among the grass. And I think ever since seeing these things, I've always had this kind of love affair with forgotten, failing, decaying technology.
Could you talk about the role of science in science fiction?
Science and science fiction has always been, people always talk about hard SF, which is the kind of nuts and bolts end, where kind of SF that was often written by people like Robert Heinlein, where the writer strives to get the facts right, make it plausible. So if you're going to have a rocket orbiting the moon, you sort of make sure that the period of the orbit's correct, and you make sure that you don't have stupid things like helicopters on the moon where there's no air, that kind of stuff. This is kind of SF that appeals to me, but also I also find that there's a lot about it that I really dislike. It's SF that attracts a certain right-wing mindset for some reason, and that's not me at all. So I always have a love-hate affair with SF that is dominated by scientific thinking, and it can often be very doctrinal, rigid, unwilling to look at any other viewpoints. And as a reader, I'm equally drawn to softer types of SF. Like, one of my favorite writers is Philip K. Dick, who just clearly knew very little science and didn't care about it, but just knew how to write engaging stories that would just play with your mind in really unpleasant disorientating ways. And again, Samuel R. Delaney, another writer I really admire. And one of my favorite books is his space opera Nova from the late 60s, which is just a really rip-roaring, spectacular, colorful, swashbuckling epic a 1,000 years from now in a far future context with lots of colonized planets and space travel. And it's just fantastic. And you think this is just such a brilliant book, but the science in it is just totally crackers. But you don't care because it's self-consistent. So I have some ambivalent feelings about the degree to which science should inflict itself within science fiction.
So, do you think that science fiction writers have a responsibility to educate their readers?
Not at all. I think this is no. If you want to know about science, go and read a popular science book or get a science career. But you don't read ghost stories expecting to learn about ghosts. No, I think this is totally wrong. And in fact, I don't like being educated. I like being entertained. I think science fiction is not the place for science education. And in fact, science fiction can be very damaging to science education because of the sort of, in a lot of science fiction books, and particularly in the media, there's no clear distinction between rigorous science and completely made-up bogus science. There's just a spectrum. On one level, you've got Star Trek, where they have, at times, quite cogent scientific storylines, where they have, they refer to different types of astronomical object and things like that. And at the other end, you've got them sort of, they'll come up with some sort of wacky particle of the week to solve whatever mystery needs to be solved. And I think if you're not scientifically minded, you can't tell what the hell is real and what's bogus.
Thank you very much. We've just been speaking with Alistair Reynolds, award-winning science fiction writer from Wales. Thanks, Alistair.
Thanks very much.